Hello and welcome to Marketing Beats, Marketing Bites. Thank you for joining us today as we are speaking to some experts from within the world of marketing, bringing you a fresh new perspective on the industry. My name is Jackie Parr, I'm the editor of Marketing Beat and I'll be your host for today's episode. We're talking today about the importance of brand, so I am super excited to be joined by two real experts in the field. First of all, we have Emma Baines, who is Head of Creative at Tony's Chocolonely, who will be giving us some insight into how Tony's has developed and protected its very strong brand identity. Thank you for joining us, Emma. And joining Emma is James Fuchsbell, who is Director of Brand Marketing for Frontify. So I think that means we can pick your brains about the best way to create an instantly recognisable brand. Is that right, James? That's how it's going to work, isn't it?
We can definitely give it a go, yes.
Excellent. All right, thank you both for joining us. Okay, so when we first started talking about what we were going to focus on today, we were doing so at the same sort of time that British Airways had released its recent Door series of out-of-home adverts, which were particularly notable for the lack of branding, I suppose, is the best way to describe it. So it was, if people haven't seen them, it was the doors of the planes and little peek through into the cabin and showing little snippets of BA identity. So that was really interesting. And we were talking around how BA has such a strong, recognisable brand that it was able to do that. So with that in mind, and looking at other brands that have done similar things, like Specsavers, Müller with its famous big out-of-home, which just shows the corner of the corner yogurt, is having an instantly recognisable brand the holy grail of marketing? Emma, I'm going to come to you first. On Tony's Chocolonely and its recognisability, I suppose, how it stands out on shelf, can you tell us a little bit about that and how it works so well for you?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. First off, having a recognisable brand is absolutely the ultimate goal, isn't it? We talk a lot about a sea of sameness in brands out there. And by having that very different brand and that standout brand and those key brand codes that we talk about, that's just going to cut through that, really. So that is, first off, that's to answer the question on that. It's absolutely kind of where we have to kind of aim for as brands. And then I guess the other part of that is, yeah, I talk about brand codes, but it's also this combination of, yeah, okay, you can have your font and you can have your logo and you can have the colours that you use, but it's also about evoking emotion. And I think those two things go hand in hand. And that's absolutely something that we've obviously do at Tony's Chocolonely. Yes, you are probably super familiar with our really distinct brand assets. So again, the fonts, the hand-cut lettering font, the DIY-ness of it, and the colour's red, the kind of really different way in which we approach our packaging, the different way in which we approach our products as well. But basically just not following the rules is also helpful to kind of make us stand out. I love the quote by John Hegarty, which is, when the world zigs, you zag. And I just think that really helps to be able to build a brand that stands out in the sea of sameness. And I really, truly believe that Tony's has done that across all of our assets and all of the application of those as well, by building on our mission, which is at the core of everything that we do as well. So by having this great, I mean, we're very lucky, I think, you know, a few years ago, purpose was this big statement for brands. It was like, oh, you've got to have a purpose. You've got to have a purpose. And when I was working agency side, that was every brief. We need to find our purpose. And Tony's was built on a purpose. It already had one. It had a very clear mission. And so anything that we built on top of that had to be different as well to stand out. And that's kind of where we're at with it, really.
Tapping into that for a second, because that's really interesting what you were just saying about purpose being sort of the bedrock of the brand, I suppose. Mm. Did that change how you built out those brand assets? How much importance was put onto the purpose part of the brand when choosing the look and the style and kind of how Tony's sits on a shelf amongst all the other brands?
I can't take credit for this. This is our creative director, Arjen Klinkenberg, Klink, as he likes to be known. And the story of that, I believe it's in a documentary as well called the Chocolate Story online. But the story is really great. And it's one of the first questions I asked him when I joined Tony's, actually. It was like, how did you come up with this brand? Because it's a story everyone wants to know. And I believe, gosh, I hope I'm getting this right. It was... it was almost like a competition. He got given this brief of, hey, we need to create a brand for a chocolate bar. And he met Toon van der Koken, who set up Tony Chocolonely. He is a Dutch journalist who had seen that there was a problem firsthand from being out in West Africa. He'd seen that there was a problem in the cocoa industry, tried to change things, tried to sue himself, tried to get arrested, all these things didn't go down well. Or didn't work. So then he was like, right, I'm going to make change from within. So hence the first chocolate bar. And the thinking behind some of the codes there and the designs in the first place for the original red milk chocolate bar, which is also our brand logo, which is different to other brands, mm-hmm. was to have this great font, which is literally hand cut. I think Clink did like 2 or 3 versions and was like, yeah, that one will do. Much like how a lot of brands, when they first kind of start, go. So he created that. And then they were like, right. It was also quite subversive at the time because the color in the Netherlands, this is like 20 years ago, the color that is most often connected to milk chocolate was blue. And so Tony's were like, right, okay, we're going to go red, which also is this kind of state of alarm. So that was also something that was really important in the design, was to kind of just be different. We don't have the product unpackage, which a lot of people do. And we're just very different. We're very playful. We stand out in a crowd.
James, coming to you for a second, how powerful, because Emma's right, Tony's absolutely stands out on shelf. And I think actually, even in the UK, it's not so much that it's always blue, but it's certainly like blues and purples. There's real tones, isn't there, that we expect to see from chocolate bars on shelf. So Tony's really stands out in that. James, how powerful is that instant recognition for a brand, and how can other brands take kind of those keys and make the most of what they're doing and I suppose truly own their own assets?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a big question, isn't it? And I think it sort of almost depends in category. You know, you've kind of, the zig, the zag, you know, quote you just brought up, Emma, you know, it's that kind of in category, like T-Mobile against a sea of sans serifs in the telco industry, you know, or in your industry, in the chocolate industry, kind of just breaking out of that. You've got such an ownable asset there. But yeah, how you get to that place as well and create recall, create that sort of memorability of your brand just over time is something you need to just keep leaning on. When you brought up a couple of great examples of like British Airways, you know, Müller as well. I can think of another one, Cornetto recently, that kind of almost lowest common denominator branding, I call it almost, where you've got just a bit of the type, just a bit of the color. And then like you've just described, Emma, that sort of emotion. So whether it's the tear of the Cornetto wrap or whether it's just the sort of light of an aircraft at altitude, sort of takes you to that place. And what's the sort of smallest amount of each of those ingredients, color, type, fuselage, whatever those things are, emotion, that help carry that message, which is you. But yeah, to get to that place where you can be as bold as that, that's a tricky question.
I would imagine that behind the scenes, and Emma, you mentioned being agency side previously, so maybe you'll be able to give a bit of insight on this. I imagine that there's discussions being had where the creatives are very keen to, like you say, James, just use a hint, whether it's a bit of the colour or a bit of the imagery or whatever it is to suggest the brand, where the boardroom are like, actually, no, we need to make sure we use the brand. We've invested a huge amount into building this brand. We are not going to let people potentially miss it. Where's that balance?
That's a great question. I think it's about knowing where you're at with your brand as well, and understanding not just the role that you play within the market, but like what is your level of brand awareness in the markets that you're trying to be in. For example, if you're a brand that's sort of a couple of years old in its infancy and you have very low brand awareness, then you're not going to be able to do the types of creative that is a little bit kind of out there, and you've got no product and you've got no brand in there. So I'm thinking about like the McDonald's Raise Your Arches ad recently. Like McDonald's is okay. I mean, I'd be hard pushed to find someone that hasn't heard of McDonald's. Is that, I guess it's a question, and I think I can answer it, which is it because of their high brand recognition that they can do an ad without a product, without any form of branding other than actually eyebrows that look like arches. Like, it's kind of, that's brave and it's bold, and I think it's one of the best examples. But of course, they have huge brand recognition. And it's something we ask ourselves as well, because I think there is this view, especially for Tonys, that we are more well known than we actually are. I think in certain circles we are. So if I think about the marketing industry, everyone's like, yeah, Tonys. But actually our brand awareness levels in the Netherlands, we've been going 20 years here, it's really high. It's in the like top 90s. Whereas in some of our other markets, we've got work to do. So I think that kind of shocks people sometimes. So sometimes what we can do in the Netherlands, and this is a challenge creatively as well, is what we can do in the Netherlands is quite different to what we're actually trying to do in the UK, which is strengthen that brand recognition and be top of mind.
That's really interesting. I hadn't thought of it from a territory perspective before, but actually that makes a lot of sense. James, we were speaking a second ago about when we were talking about owning assets and things. And it's just something I wanted to come back to for you, because it was, I just wanted to know what, I want you to explain it actually. You mentioned about T-Mobile and Sans Serif. Is that a particularly well-known example of a brand coming in and disrupting in the same way that Tonys has? Because if it is, it's not one that I'm aware of. So it'd be quite nice to explain that to the listeners and me. And
yeah, it's funny. I mean, at the time when it came out, at least in the UK, you know, everything else from Orange, you know, all the competitors were all this kind of sans serif, you know, kind of very clean, not sterile, but kind of much more clean and simple. And T-Mobile kind of came out with the sort of serif, you know, with the edges to the typeface itself. And I just think that's like a fairly bold example. You know, I can think of other places in other categories like luxury, you know, Dunhill coming out against some of the more kind of traditional brands that went back way further than them, and sort of going way north with their D's and their L's, this kind of, in reality, quite a crazy design in comparison to some of the others. So I think it depends when, you know, when you're established within your category to some extent. And sort of if you're going to enter that category, kind of being bold about it, essentially, to be able to compete versus the more established players, the number ones, the number twos, you know, they're sort of already bedded into the psyche and the minds of various people. You know, potentially you could say the same about crypto, Web3, you know, even CBD branding. You know, they don't have a category yet. And if you look at those categories, they're all fairly similar right now. Is there somebody that's going to come play outside of that and shake that up at some point? And then also you look at technology and consumer technology products, you know, look at the old Microsoft logos and identities compared to where they are today. You know, so much more soul and vibe, actually quite mad in comparison to where things are today. And that's interesting, whether that's going to spike back to another dimension, you know, whether it's nostalgia or some other place that breaks that category. And there's maybe, I don't know, there's philosophies going on in all sorts of ways, and we're getting so used to utility and what's normal in category there. So how do you have a soul and a personality and a flavor and a voice inside of that utility now that anyone can technically deliver the same as you? You know, it's quite easy to join that bandwagon now.
So I think this whole like new age of digital, I sound so old school there. A lot of brands, I think, lost a lot of that character in that. And I think it's been really interesting because from the examples that you were just giving were brands that were kind of shaking things up. Whereas I've noticed that a lot of brands over the last kind of 10, 15 years have tried to actually go the other way and just become so basic. And like, you know, you put like 3, 4, 5 brands even in the same sector together and you kind of like, well, where's any differentiation? And I think that's driven a lot by a lot, you know, this shift onto digital and digital marketing and various things. So there's a couple of examples actually that spring to mind, which is the Gap rebrand from about 15 years ago, where obviously Gap has this, what we know and love today. They tried to change it and it looked like the, what was then Facebook, now Meta logo. And there was huge uproar. And look, is any kind of PR good PR? But still, it was like they reversed the decision. So that must have been hundreds of thousands for a rebrand. But that was wild. And another one that springs to mind is also Tropicana. So everyone's like, we're fine with this. This is cool. This is old school. We like this branding. It feels like authentic, which I think is really key. And then you've seen this shift to, okay, the sea of sameness. We're all the same. Why should I buy Tropicana over that own label, which is probably cheaper? I'm going to go for that because I have this is not bringing me anything. There's no value add here. And then another brand that I thought was really interesting that's happened recently, and everyone's talking about it, and I'd love to know, there's lots of discussion on it, which is Liquid Death, which is absolutely like disrupting the water category. Like, great products, like it's water in a can, call it Liquid Death. And there's lots of, you know, contradicting opinions around that one as well. But I do think what my personal opinion on that is, like, way to go. Like, you, everyone's talking about you. It's really interesting. You're completely disrupting everything.
Tropicana is a great example that you mentioned, Emma, because potentially they forgot the consumer and why the consumer liked Tropicana. It was because it was different. It was because it had that old school sort of security feeling. A second ago, when you were talking about the way things sit on shelves and sort of standing out in a sea of sameness, I saw something, I think it was only last week, and it was very much talking to that. So there was coffee on shelf, and it's lots of brown jars with the red lids, and there's a coffee brand, and I cannot remember the name of it, I'm really sorry. It's packaged and positioned as if it's medicine. So it's in white tubs. It looked like something had been merchandised in the wrong space. So yes, they were getting attention. Yes, they stood out against the other coffee brands, but there were no signifiers. There was no, like, this is a coffee. It looked like it was in the wrong place. So there's a line as well, isn't there, that brands have to sort of still toe the line to a certain extent, because they still need to be seen as a chocolate bar, as orange juice, or as a sort of tub of coffee. And it's hitting that right mark, I think.
I think in some categories, have we tripped ourselves up a bit with this sort of repeatability and the scale needs of a global firm, and, you know, having to be able to do things fast and wide, and sort of in that, applying that sameness and lowest common denominator of usability and function across all. And there's got to be a space of play, surely. I think consistency kind of totally matters, but there's a point in which you need to be able to play and be relevant, and, you know, be specific to whether that's a region or a moment or a persona.
Within a single brand, James, how important is consistency? Can brands play around with things a bit?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, there are stats out there in Lucid Press Demand Metric, I think it's one of the ones I've lent on in the past. I think they attribute 33% of company revenue to a consistent brand. How exactly that's measured would be interesting to duck into. But, you know, it obviously is important for that sort of familiarity and building that recall and memorability in your brand. But I would say that there's sort of where it gets applied, how it gets applied in what sort of formula. I think that should be, you know, thought about by the brand, depending on which category they're in. Obviously, seasonality hugely matters. And in the end, I don't know, Do we fall in love with consistency as people, and like that perfection? And we like quirks as well as humans. So kind of having that surprise, that delight there at some point in the brand recipe, I think matters.
Coming back to you very quickly, Emma, we talked about owning brand assets and keeping control of them. Tony's has had copycats, particularly recently. You were in the news because Lidl bought out a bar that looked, should we just say, similar. But it wasn't just about the way it was packaged, was it? It was also about the bar itself. I think Tony's is designed not in its nice equal even chunks for a specific reason, and that element of the bar was copied as well. How do you protect brand assets?
I hear cease and desist letters help, but on a more practical side, I think at the end of the day, yes, brands, look, we've got to be creative, and we've got to be a bit strategic about, you know, how we protect our identity. In the Lidl case, I mean, as I've mentioned, it was just super. Is it surprising to see it? I think no, because...
I mean, no.
No. But it's just, it's just so not cool. Like, I think that's the thing, that the element that we really wanted to, you know, we really want people to actually join our mission. And so, you know, source your cocoa beans through us, copy that part. That's the important part. Don't just copy the design, because it's fun and it's quirky. And I think there's a couple of things you can do there, and what we try and do and to counteract this is just basically continually elevate what makes us unique and lean into our quirks, create products. And we have this thing called the Tony's twist, you know, what makes it only Tony's? And actually, by owning that, we own that narrative. We own the story of the unequally divided bar. So by leaning into that, only us can really tell that story. Sure, Lidl have got a bar that's unequally divided. great. What's the backstory? What's the reason? What's the authentic story behind it? And ours is our mission. You know, we have the coast of West Africa, a little known fact, we have the coast of West Africa included in our bar, and it represents the unequally divided cocoa industry. So only we can tell that story. It's unique for us, and it doesn't quite cut the mustard for Lidl, who are just kind of, you know, not doing what we're doing. And staying one step ahead, copycats can only copy what's out there. We stay innovative, we stay doing things a bit differently. Then we're the only ones that can kind of, as I mentioned, owned that. And just try not to react. You know, there are brands out there that do react to certain things. We've got to just use those situations to highlight what makes our brand special and why we do what we do. Why is our bar unequally divided versus Lidl's, for example? And sometimes we do this with newsjacking if we think it's a story worth mm-hmm. discussing, and we're a bit cheeky with that. Not exactly specific to this case, but Toblerone, I think it was about a year and a half ago, they had to change their packaging because they were changing supplier. They were no longer being, their cocoa or their chocolate was no longer being manufactured in Switzerland. So they had to remove the mountain from their packaging. And so we were just like, well, why don't you replace it with the Tony's Open Chain logo? Join the Tony's Open Chain, join our mission, source your cocoa through the Tony's Open Chain, commit to our 5 sourcing principles, and then we've got an answer to your problems. So yeah, I just kind of love that example to give, because that's just a way that we can try and kind of be culturally relevant as well, and just invite others to join our mission.
And did Toblerone take that suggestion on board?
Not to my knowledge.
Oh, that's a shame.
It's an open invite, Toblerone.
James, for your perspective on that side of things, how important is it that brands are able to protect their assets and the brand recognition that they've built up? How important is it that they can stop them? And when brands are copied or emulated or paid tribute to, there's lots of different ways people describe and justify what they're doing. Does it devalue the brand that sort of led the way, or does it put them out in front as a market leader? What's your take on that?
No, it's a really interesting question. It's a hard one to answer that. I mean, I'll come at it from a kind of brand ingredients lens. You know, if we took, let's isolate typography for a minute. So if you sort of pulled out the Oakley's O in your mind, the IBM I, you know, Disney D, then we can already see like those brands are owned in our mind, perhaps in their category. It's pretty hard to jump to those places and without coming across, you know, as a knockoff version of them, a counterfeit version of them. But then like same category of typography, let's go into sort of fashion, and everybody sort of going down luxury fashion, particularly, you know, getting rid of the serif, getting rid of that elegance and going down a kind of same sans route at the same time. So they're all sort of from distinctive to then sameness, ownable nature in terms of color. You've got Tiffany's is kind of bright in my mind, you know, Coca-Cola obviously as well. Again, in category, I think they can to some extent own it, but it doesn't mean that somebody can't come across and copy. To your kind of question on, you know, who comes first and the follower, I always just see that as it's a nice thing to see for that brand that came first, that someone's come and followed them. It's their turn then to shake it up a bit further, perhaps move to another place that the others have just caught up to. So it's a hard one to answer that, because I think, again, if you're a category leader, it's probably easier to stay in that position versus a joiner to the party.
But then, and this is actually what brings us very neatly onto the next point that I wanted to make, so that then, if you are a brand leader and you've you know set out these category signifiers, which you're using a lot and which then other people have started to use, then the next, either you sort of dig deep and you keep that and you double down, or you rebrand. Now, we've discussed a few rebrands that have gone wrong. And also, if you've spent a lot of time building up your brand and setting out so you're really strong and consistent and recognisable, which is what we're speaking about here, then what are the dangers and benefits of undertaking a rebrand? Is it something that Tony's would ever consider, Emma, or is it very much evolution rather than revolution?
Absolutely not. No, we're not looking to do any kind of rebranding anytime soon. As we scale, obviously, there are things we need to kind of tweak and and to be able to do that. But no, absolutely. We're blessed with a very, very strong brand with strong codes. Where I was before that, I was at HelloFresh before Tony Schiaccolone, and I led a rebrand there that was really interesting. And one of the main reasons, there were multiple reasons for the rebrand at the time, but the main reason is the brand was no longer fit for purpose. And one of my favorite examples of this was we did an audit of the brand, and just looking at it was just like painful to the eyes. But one of the things was, is that the actual logo itself, there were more than 20 variations in use across all of our assets, which showed us very clearly this logo, only the logo is not fit for purpose. And that was for many reasons. We'd kind of grown and there'd been no one kind of managing that growth from a brand and creative perspective. And so our SVP global brand at the time was like, we need to do something about this. And we did. And that was one of the main reasons. And you can also talk about, you know, consolidating brand architecture and growth and modernizing and all those things. But if you have a brand that's no longer fit for purpose and you don't know how to use that logo across the basic applications you're using on a day-to-day basis, and it's posing and it's giving you more problems than it is solutions, then you've got a problem, and you should probably consider that.
Just sticking with that a bit longer, because that's actually really interesting what you were just saying. And the idea of having 20 different iterations of the logo is terrifying, actually. So was the rebrand a dramatic rebrand, or was it very much a, right, okay, let's cut this out, we'll just stick to the two or three versions that we know we need? Or was it a complete rework?
So it started off being light touch, but then as because that was the appetite from the C level. As we kind of made our way through the project and, you know, baby steps, we took a lot of small steps before we started running. And as we put forward more and more rationale and more reasons, and we provided all the problems we were facing and could show them in real time. And, you know, that was how we actually ended up with a complete rebrand. But what we did do is we looked, and this was a really fun exercise, but we looked at there was very clear elements we did not want to change, i.e. name was never even on the table, and the color as well. Green was always going to be synonymous with HelloFresh. The color green changed, and you were talking about colors earlier, James. We went through iterations of colors. I think I looked at every version of green there is in the world. How does it look on print? How does it look on screen? How do we feel about it? There was a lot of questions there. So yeah, it ended up being a huge evolution, and it's something that I am pretty proud of to this date, because it was a major undertaking to rebrand a company like HelloFresh and get everyone on board as well. So, and I actually see it every now and then. There's the delivery vans, and seeing the logo that you're like, ah, I looked at all those greens. And that typeface we talked about for weeks on end. So to see it out live and in the wild is really, that was a proud moment.
Is that a typical kind of experience, James, that if brands are going to rebrand, whether it ends up being a big thing or more of an evolution, that it is that on, it's more of a fine tune. Is that, again, brands playing a bit safe? Like, you know, you want to keep the name, you want to keep the green, you've got to keep that level of consistency. And if so, what would you say to anyone listening that is thinking, oh, you know, we need to push our brand forward, it's got a bit messy, we've got too many versions of the same thing kicking around. How should they do that? How should they pull everything together and take their brand to the next level?
Yeah, I mean, it's, whenever any rebrand comes out, I always think about the people in house and the hill they've had to, the mountain they've had to climb to, like, one, push the value of this project against all the other projects. To the upheaval of trying to run this thing through an organization and get it out through the various touch points. It's colossal. And to think about a sort of transformational shift in a rebrand and the sort of belief you've got to build to sort of make that happen consensus-wise across an org, it's huge. It's absolutely massive. And I don't know, I think I'm with Emma. It's like you've almost got to treat it as an ongoing evolution, in my opinion. Like, the world around us is changing constantly, and the idea that you could kind of predict the next 10 years and this thing's going to last and it doesn't need touching for until the end of that 10 years is kind of almost complete madness, because you've got tech shifts, you've got new products coming through, you've got new services or whatever those things are, society's moving on as well. And so it's almost like painting a bridge. Once you've got to the other side, you've got to start again, because something else has changed or rusted or what have you. So it's almost like a constant commitment for me, I think. And, you know, having the right sort of insights into your brand to kind of feed off that, I think really matters. And then the right sort of systems and people around you to kind of make that happen in a fluid form, I think really matters. But yeah, it's interesting. I was looking at I don't know if you guys saw the Lloyds rebrand that just came through.
Yeah.
I think it was yesterday that just launched. And quite an interesting one, isn't it? Because you can see they're up against like the Monzos, the Stripes, all the sort of, you know, digital first brands as a kind of real traditional brand. And everyone else has gone down a kind of a certain route, and they've now gone and sort of planted a real big flag, almost somewhere in the middle, but a bit closer to the digi first brands. And yeah, so that's it. I can just imagine the team in house there when I saw that yesterday, and the sort of the pressure to get that right, and the belief in even doing that project against all the other goals the company has at the time.
Do you think they got it right? Do you think they've nailed it? Or should they have been braver? Should they have not gone that far?
I think it's a fantastic flag in the ground to me. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think we'll see other traditional banks following suit?
I think you've seen a few others already gone live with theirs, and maybe they've picked their territory, and now Lloyds have kind of picked a different one. So it's really interesting that how they both evolve, and whether some of the other banks which haven't yet evolved, whether they sort of come close to, you know, the Nationwides and the NatWest, or whether they're near the Lloyds, or whether they're over by the Monzos. So it's interesting. And I like seeing that in category, when someone's kind of, you can just tell the belief that they have and the effort they've gone to kind of plant that flag in the ground.
But you're absolutely right. The in-house brands at those other banks are going to be having lots of conversations, aren't they?
Definitely.
Circling back, actually, to the very beginning of our conversation, I'm just cautious of timing at the moment. We spoke about BA. We've also spoken about Tropicana. With all of everything that we've said, everything that we've covered, from colour to typography to consistency to fluid elements, all of those things, what's the holy grail of branding from your perspective? And to that end, what does staying on brand really mean? Emma, we'll start with you.
What a lovely question to answer. So the for me, how I view it and think about it is that the holy grail of branding is to create a brand that is authentic and that emotionally connects with your audience and the community. It's consistent, we've talked a lot about that today, and also adaptable and can grow and flex and move. Staying on brand is the commitment to uphold those values as well that each brand has, and to be able to make themselves a trusted and meaningful part of people's lives. I think Simon Sinek said, you know, people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. And I think that's really key.
Love that final quote. James, same question to you. Holy grail of branding.
Yeah, maybe it's such a big question. I could say so many different things here, and also I could say nothing, but I'll go to a place in my heart. So I started out working at Burberry, and at the time it was this kind of quite diluted, this is 20 odd years ago, quite diluted brand. It was on, you know, cat collars, dog bowls, hooliganism, all sorts of things at the time. And we were part of this team that was kind of just trying to find what Burberry was again. And we were sort of pouring into the archives, looking at sort of what it meant, and trying to sort of, I guess, reassemble it and concentrate it again. And I sort of, I left there, and you know, things happened with the Sands route at some point. And I remember looking back at that going, it's a real, real shame. I can see why they did do it, because of the world of digital and whatever, everything was going on in that category. But to see what they've done now in going back to their roots and placing the bets there, but equally in the right way in innovation too. I'm sort of really excited about where they do go next and where they push it further forward. So it's sort of, it's hard, isn't it? You've got to almost like reassess what you are, and we're doing that all the time as humans as well. What recipe do you use? And to your point, Emma, like how does that, how can you make sure that lasts in the right way for all the different shifts that do go on in the world around us? So Yeah, big question that. I went quite deep there, sorry.
I love that. I enjoyed it.
You've mentioned a few times, and I know that was meant to be our last question, so this is the final point, but you mentioned a few times, and I really want to get your perspective on this, James, before we close, and then we will stop, I promise, the importance of typography and the importance of logo within branding. Obviously, branding is more than just that, but we've seen quite a lot, I think, over the last maybe 5-10 years, lots of brands changing their logos so that they, and luxury brands we see it a lot with as well, changing their logos so they can be replicated easier online for a digital world. So where before brands would have been used really extraordinary typography or just used hand-drawn imagery or whatever it was, that has now often been kind of homogenized. So it all looks very samey. From your perspective, James, just because you've mentioned typography so much, what's your take on that?
It was some place people had to go at the time, and it's great they all did it, but I don't think they need to. There's a need to anymore, would be my kind of short summary of that. And there's loads of reasons for it, from, you know, screens have just got so much bigger and better resolution-wise. I think you can sort of find other ways to stand out in that really shorthand, like social favicon, you know, environment as well. So yeah, I'm praying and hoping that there's going to be this kind of return to play. You know, in the same way, you know, Emma's brand does exactly that. Like, I don't think we need to kind of go to such safe places to sort of hold up in such functional ways. We do need to hold up in functional ways, but I don't think we need to kind of make our brands aesthetically functional in the process too. So I hope people listening to this go off and tear up a bit of their guidelines and
yeah,
hear, hear.
Brilliant. That's a perfect note to end on. So we're telling people to stay on brand, but also be different, I think.
Definitely.
With it as well. Thank you very much. Thank you both so much for joining me. It's been a fascinating conversation. But thank you very much, and thanks to our listeners. Thank you.